Disc 7.
In spite of our doubts, the radio man was as good as his word. He seemed to have complete confidence that his instinct for mechanism would not let him down. After practicing for half an hour, he took the helicopter off and flew it back to Charkat. For 4 days, the machine hovered around in widening circles. On 2 of them, Coker observed. On the other 2, I replaced him. In all, we discovered 10 little groups of people. None of them knew anything of the Beadley party, and none of them contained Jazella. As we found each lot, we landed. Usually they were in 2s and 3s. The largest was 7. They would greet us in hopeful excitement, but soon, when they found that we represented only a group similar to their own, and were not the spearhead of a rescue party on the grand scale, their interest would lapse. We could offer them little that they had not got already. Some of them became irrationally abusive and threatening in their disappointment, but most simply dropped back into despondency. As a rule, they showed little wish to join up with other parties, and were inclined rather to lay hands on what they could, building themselves into refugees as comfortably as possible while they waited for the arrival of the Americans who were bound to find a way. There seemed to be a widespread and fixed idea about this. Our suggestions that any surviving Americans would be likely to have their hands more than full at home was received as so much wet blanketry. The Americans, they assured us, would never have allowed such a thing to happen in their country. Nevertheless, and in spite of this Micawber fixation on American fairy godmothers, we left each party with a map showing them the approximate positions of groups we had already discovered, in case they should change their minds and think about getting together for self-help. As a task, the flights were far from enjoyable, but at least they were to be preferred to lonely scouting on the ground. However, at the end of the fruitless 4th day, it was decided to abandon the search. At least, that was what the rest of them decided. I did not feel the same way about it. My quest was personal, theirs was not. Whoever they found, now or eventually, would be strangers to them. I was searching for Beadley's party as a means, not an end in itself. If I should find them and discover that Gisella was not with them, then I should go on searching. But I could not expect the rest to devote any more time to searching purely on my behalf. Curiously, I realized that in all this I had met no other person who was searching for someone else. Every one of them had been, save for the accident of Stephen and his girlfriend, snapped clean away from friends or relatives to link him with the past, and was beginning a new life with people who were strangers. Only I, as far as I could see, had promptly formed a new link, and that so briefly that I had scarcely been aware how important it was to me at the time. Once the decision to abandon the search had been taken, Coker said, "All right, then that brings us to thinking about what we're going to do for ourselves." "Which means laying in stores against the winter and just going on as we are. What else should we do?" asked Stephen. "I've been thinking about that," Coker told him. "Maybe it'd be all right for a while, but what happens afterwards?" "If we do run short of stocks, well, there's plenty more lying around," said the radio man.
"The Americans will be here before Christmas," said Stephen's girlfriend.
"Listen," Coker told her patiently, "just put the Americans in the jam tomorrow pie in the sky department a while, will you? Try to imagine a world in which there aren't any Americans. Can you do that?" The girl stared at him.
"But there must be," she said.
Coker sighed sadly. He turned his attention to the radio man.
"There won't always be those stores. The way I see it, we've been given a flying start in a new kind of world. We're endowed with a capital of enough of everything to begin with. But that isn't going to last forever. We couldn't eat up all the stuff that's there for the taking, not in generations. If it would keep. But it isn't going to keep. A lot of it's going to go bad pretty rapidly. And not only food, everything is going, more slowly but quite surely, to drop in pieces. If we want fresh stuff to eat next year, we shall have to grow it ourselves. And it may seem a long way off now, but there's going to come a time when we shall have to grow everything ourselves. There'll come a time, too, when all the tractors are worn out or rusted, and there's no more petrol to run them anyway. When we'll come right down to nature and bless horses, if we've got 'em."
This is a pause. Just a heaven-sent pause while we get over the first shock and start to collect ourselves. But it's no more than a pause. Later, we'll have to plough.
Still later, we'll have to learn how to make ploughshares. Later than that, we'll have to learn how to smelt iron to make the shares. What we are on now is a road that will take us back and back and back until we can, if we can, make good all that we wear out. Not until then shall we be able to stop ourselves on the trail that's leading down to savagery. But once we can do that, then maybe we'll begin to crawl slowly up again. He looked round the circle to see if we were following him. We can do that, if we will. The most valuable part of our flying start is knowledge. That's the shortcut to save us starting where our ancestors did. We've got it all there in the books if we take the trouble to find out about it.
The rest were looking at Coco curiously. It was the first time they had heard him in one of his oratorical moods.
Now, he went on, from my reading of history, the thing you have to use knowledge is leisure. Where everybody has to work hard just to get a living and there is no leisure to think, knowledge stagnates, and people with it. The thinking has to be done largely by people who are not directly productive, by people who appear to be living almost entirely on the work of others, but are, in fact, a long-term investment. Learning grew up in the cities and in great institutions. It was the labour of the countryside that supported them. Do you agree with that?
Stephen knitted his brows.
More or less, but I don't see what you're getting at.
It's this, the economic size. A community of our present size cannot hope to do more than exist and decline. If we stay here as we are now, just 10 of us now, the end is quite inevitably a gradual and useless fade-out. If there are children, we shall be able to spare only enough time from our labour to give them just a rudimentary education. One generation further and we shall have savages or clods. To hold our own, to make any use at all of the knowledge in the libraries, we must have the teacher, the doctor, and the leader. And we must be able to support them while they help us.
Well, said Stephen, after a pause.
I've been thinking of that place Bill and I saw at Tynesham. We've told you about it. The woman who's tried to run it wanted help, and she wanted it badly. She has about 50 or 60 people on her hands, and a dozen or so of them able to see. That way, she can't do it. She knows she can't, but she wasn't going to admit it to us. She wasn't going to put herself in our debt by asking us to stay. But she'd be very glad if we were to go back there after all and ask to be admitted.
Good Lord, I said. You don't think she deliberately put us on the wrong track?
I don't know. I might be doing her an injustice, but it is an odd thing that we've not seen or heard a single sign of Beadley and Co., isn't it? Anyhow, whether she meant it or not, that's the way it works, because I've decided to go back there. If you want my reasons, here they are. Two main ones. First, unless that place is taken in hand, it's going to crash, which would be a waste and a shame for all those people there. The other is that it's much better situated than this. It has a farm, which should not take a lot of putting in order. It is practically self-contained, but could be extended if necessary. This place would cost a lot more labour to start and to work. More important, it is big enough to afford time for teaching. Teaching both the present blind there and the sighted children they'll have later on. I believe it can be done, and I'll do my best to do it, and if the haughty Miss Durrant can't take it, she can go and jump in the river. Now, the point is this. I think I could do it as it stands. But I know that if the lot of us were to go, we could get the place reorganized and running in a few weeks. Then we'd be living in a community that's going to grow and make a damn good attempt to hold its own. The alternative is to stay in a small party which is going to decline and get more desperately lonely as time goes on. So, how about it? There was some debate and inquiry for details, but not much doubt. Those of us who had been out on the search had a glimpse of the awful loneliness that might come. No one was attached to the present house. It had been chosen for its defensible qualities, and had little more to commend it. Most of them could feel the oppression of isolation growing round them already. The thought of wider and more varied company was in itself attractive. The end of an hour found the discussion dealing with questions of transport and details of the removal, and the decision to adopt Coker's suggestion had more or less made itself. Only Stephen's girlfriend was doubtful.
This place, Tynesham, is pretty much off the map, she asked uneasily.
Don't you worry, Coker reassured her.
It's marked on all the best American maps. It was sometime in the early hours of the following morning that I knew I was not going to Tynesham with the rest. Later, perhaps I would, but not yet. My first inclination had been to accompany them, if only for the purpose of choking the truth out of Miss Durrant regarding the Beadley party's destination. But then I had to make again the disturbing admission that I did not know that Josella was with them, and indeed that all the information I had been able to collect so far suggested that she was not. She had pretty certainly not passed through Tynesham. But if she had not gone in search of them, then where had she gone? It was scarcely likely that there had been a second direction in the university building, one that I had missed. And then, as if it had been a flash of light, I recalled the discussion we had had in our commandeered flat. I could see her sitting there in her blue party frock, with the light of the candles catching the diamonds as we talked. What about the Sussex Downs? I know a lovely old farmhouse on the north side. And then I knew what I must do. I told Coker about it in the morning. He was sympathetic, but obviously anxious not to raise my hopes too much.
Okay. You do as you think best, he agreed. I hope... Well, anyway, you know where we are, and you can both come on to Tynesham and help to put that woman through the hoop until she sees sense.
That morning the weather broke. The rain was falling in sheets as I climbed once more into the familiar lorry. Yet I was feeling elated and hopeful. It could have rained 10 times harder without depressing me or altering my plan. Coker came out to see me off. I knew why he made a point of it, for I was aware without his telling me that the memory of his first rash plan and its consequences troubled him. He stood beside the cab with his hair flattened and the water trickling down his neck, and held up his hand.
Take it easy, Bill. There aren't any ambulances these days, and she'll prefer you to arrive all in one piece. Good luck. And my apologies for everything to the lady, when you find her.
The word was when, but the tone was if. I wished them well at Tynesham. Then I let in the clutch and splashed away down the muddy drive. Chapter 13 Journey in Hope. The morning was infected with minor mishaps. First it was water in the carburetor, then I contrived to travel 12 miles north under the impression I was going east, and before I had that fully rectified I was in trouble with the ignition system on a bleak upland road miles from anywhere. Either these delays or a natural reaction did a lot to spoil the hopeful mood in which I had started. By the time I had the trouble straightened out it was 1 o'clock, and the day had cleared up. The sun came out. Everything looked bright and refreshed. But even that, and the fact that for the next 20 miles all went smoothly, did not shift the mood of depression that was closing over me again. Now I was really on my own. I could not shut out the sense of loneliness. It came upon me again as it had on that day when we had split up to search for Michael Beadley, only with double the force. Until then, I had always thought of loneliness as something negative, an absence of company, and of course, something temporary. That day, I had learned that it was much more. It was something which could press and oppress, could distort the ordinary and play tricks with the mind, something which lurked inimically all around, stretching the nerves and twanging them with alarms, never letting one forget that there was no one to help, no one to care. It showed one as an atom adrift in vastness. And it waited all the time its chance to frighten, and frighten horribly. That was what loneliness was really trying to do. And that was what one must never let it do. To deprive a gregarious creature of companionship is to maim it, to outrage its nature. The prisoner and the cenobite are aware that the herd exists beyond their exile. They are an aspect of it. But when the herd no longer exists, there is for the herd creature no longer entity. He is a part of no whole, a freak without a place. If he cannot hold on to his reason, then he is lost indeed, most utterly, most fearfully lost, so that he becomes no more than the twitch in the limb of a corpse. It needed far more resistance now than it had before. Only the strength of my hope that I would find companionship at my journey's end kept me from turning back to find relief from the strain in the presence of Coker and the others. The sights which I saw by the way had little or nothing to do with it. Horrible though some of them were, I was hardened to such things by now. The horror had left them just as the horror which broods over great battlefields fades into history. Nor did I any longer see these things as part of a vast, impressive tragedy. My struggle was all a personal conflict with the instincts of my kind, a continual defensive action, with no victory possible. I knew in my very heart that I would not be able to sustain myself for long alone. To give myself occupation, I drove faster than I should. In some small town with a forgotten name, I rounded a corner and ran straight into a van which blocked the whole street. Luckily, my own tough lorry suffered no more than scratches, but the two vehicles managed to hitch themselves together with diabolical ingenuity, so that it was an awkward business single-handed and in a confined space to separate them. It was a problem which took me a full hour to solve, and did me good by turning my mind to practical matters. After that, I kept to a more cautious pace, except for a few minutes soon after I entered the New Forest. The cause of that was a glimpse through the trees of a helicopter cruising at no great height. It was set to cross my course some way ahead. By ill luck, the trees there grew close to the sides of the road and must have hidden it almost completely from the air. I put on a spurt, but by the time I reached more open ground, the machine was no more than a speck floating away in the distance to the north. Nevertheless, even the sight of it seemed to give me some support. A few miles further on, I ran through a small village which was disposed neatly about a triangular green. At first sight, it was as charming in its mixture of thatched and red-tiled cottages with their flowering gardens as something out of a picture book. But I did not look too closely into the gardens as I passed. Too many of them showed the alien shape of a triffid towering incongruously among the flowers. I was almost clear of the place when a small figure bounded out of one of the last garden gates and came running up the road towards me, waving both arms. I pulled up, looking around for triffids in a way that was becoming instinctive, picked up my gun and climbed down. The child was dressed in a blue cotton frock, white socks, and sandals. She looked about 9 or 10 years old. A pretty little girl. I could see that, even though her dark brown curls were now uncared for, and her face dirtied with smeared tears. She pulled at my sleeve. "Please, please," she said urgently. "Please, come and see what's happened to Tommy." I stood staring down at her. The awful loneliness of the day lifted. My mind seemed to break out of the case I had made for it. I wanted to pick her up and hold her to me. I could feel tears close behind my eyes. I held up my hand to her, and she took it. Together we walked back to the gate through which she had gone. "Tommy's there," she said, pointing. A little boy about 4 years of age lay on the diminutive patch of lawn between the flower beds. It was quite obvious at a glance why he was there. "The thing hit him," she said. "It hit him and he fell down. And it wanted to hit me when I tried to help him. Horrible thing!" I looked up and saw the top of a triffid rising above the fence that bordered the garden. "Put your hands over your ears, I'm going to make a bang," I said. She did so, and I blasted the top off the triffid.
"Horrible thing!"
she repeated.
"Is it dead now?"
I was about to assure her that it was when it began to rattle the little sticks against its stem just as the one at Steeple Honey had done. As then, I gave it the other barrel to shut it up. "Yes," I said. "It's dead now." We walked across to the little boy. The scarlet slash of the sting was vivid on his pale cheek. It must have happened some hours before. She knelt beside him. "It isn't any good," I told her gently. She looked up, fresh tears in her eyes.
"Is Tommy dead too?"
I squatted down beside her and shook my head. "I'm afraid he is." After a while she said,
"Poor Tommy. Will we bury him?" Like the puppies?
Yes, I told her. In all the overwhelming disaster, that was the only grave I dug. And it was a very small one. She gathered a little bunch of flowers and laid them on top of it. Then we drove away. Susan was her name. A long time ago, as it seemed to her, something had happened to her father and mother so that they could not see. Her father had gone out to try and get some help, and he had not come back. Her mother went out later, giving the children strict instructions not to leave the house. She had come back crying. The next day she went out again. This time, she did not come back. The children had eaten what they could find and then began to grow hungry. At last, Susan was hungry enough to disobey instructions and seek help from Mrs. Walton at the shop. The shop itself was open, but Mrs. Walton was not there. No one came when Susan called, so she had decided to take some cakes and biscuits and sweets and tell Mrs. Walton about it later. She had seen some of the things about as she came back. One of them had struck at her, but it had misjudged her height and the sting had passed over her head. It frightened her, and she ran the rest of the way home. After that she had been very careful about the things, and on further expeditions had taught Tommy to be careful about them too. But Tommy had been so little, he had not been able to see the one that was hiding in the next garden when he went out to play that morning. Susan had tried half a dozen times to get to him, but each time, however careful she was, she had seen the top of the triffid tremble and stir slightly. An hour or so later, I decided it was time to stop for the night. I left her in the truck while I prospected a cottage or two until I found one that was fit, and then we set about getting a meal together. I did not know much of small girls, but this one seemed to be able to dispose of an astonishing quantity of the result, confessing while she did so that a diet consisting almost entirely of biscuits, cake, and sweets had proved less completely satisfying than she had expected. After we had cleaned her up a bit, and I, under instruction, had wielded her hairbrush, I began to feel rather pleased with the results. She, for her part, seemed able for a time to forget all that had happened in her pleasure at having someone to talk to. I could understand that. I was feeling exactly the same way myself. But not long after I had seen her to bed and come downstairs again, I heard the sound of sobbing. I went back to her.
"It's all right, Susan," I said. "It's all right. It didn't really hurt poor Tommy, you know. It was so quick."
I sat down on the bed beside her and took her hand. She stopped crying.
"It wasn't just Tommy," she said. "It was after Tommy, when there was nobody. Nobody at all. I was so frightened."
"I know," I told her. "I do know. I was frightened too." She looked up at me.
"But you aren't frightened now?"
"No, and you aren't either. So you see, we'll just have to keep together to stop one another being frightened."
"Yes," she agreed with serious consideration. "I think that'll be all right."
So we went on to discuss a number of things until she fell asleep.
"Where are we going?"
Susan asked as we started off again the following morning. I said that we were looking for a lady.
"Where is she?"
asked Susan. I wasn't sure of that.
"When shall we find her?"
asked Susan. I was pretty unsatisfactory about that, too.
"Is she a pretty lady?"
asked Susan. "Yes," I said, glad to be more definite this time. It seemed for some reason to give Susan satisfaction.
"Good,"
she remarked approvingly, and we passed to other subjects. Because of her, I tried to skirt the larger towns, but it was impossible to avoid many unpleasant sights in the country. After a while, I gave up pretending that they did not exist. Susan regarded them with the same detached interest as she gave to the normal scenery. They did not alarm her, though they puzzled her and prompted questions. Reflecting that the world in which she was going to grow up would have little use for the over-niceties and euphemisms that I had learnt as a child, I did my best to treat the various horrors and curiosities in the same objective fashion. That was really very good for me, too. By midday the clouds had gathered, and the rain began once more. When at 5 o'clock we had pulled up on the road just short of Pulborough, it was still pouring hard.
"Where do we go now?" inquired Susan.
"That," I acknowledged, "is just the trouble. It's somewhere over there." I waved my arm towards the misty line of the downs to the south. I had been trying hard to recall just what else Josella had said of the place, but I could remember no more than that the house stood on the north side of the hills, and I had the impression that it faced across the low, marshy country that separated them from Pulborough. Now that I had come so far, it seemed a pretty vague instruction. The downs stretched away for miles to the east and to the west.
"Maybe the first thing to do is see if we can find any smoke across there," I suggested.
"It's awfully difficult to see anything at all in the rain," Susan said, practically, and quite rightly.
Half an hour later, the rain obligingly held off for a while. We left the lorry and sat on a wall side by side. We studied the lower slopes of the hills carefully for some time, but neither Susan's sharp eyes nor my field glasses could discover any trace of smoke or signs of activity. Then it started to rain again.
"I'm hungry," said Susan.
Food was a matter of trifling interest to me just then. Now that I was so near, my anxiety to know whether my guess had been right overcame everything else. While Susan was still eating, I took the lorry a little way up the hill behind us to get a more extensive view. In between showers, and in a worsening light, we scanned the other side of the valley again without result. There was no life or movement in the whole valley save for a few cattle and sheep, and an occasional triffid lurching across the field below. An idea came to me, and I decided to go down to the village. I was reluctant to take Susan, for I knew the place would be unpleasant, but I could not leave her where she was. When we got there, I found that the sights affected her less than they did me. Children have a different convention of the fearful until they have been taught the proper things to be shocked at. The depression was all mine. Susan found more to interest than to disgust her. Any somberness was quite offset by her delight in a scarlet silk mackintosh with which she equipped herself in spite of it being several sizes too large. My search, too, was rewarding. I returned to the lorry laden with a headlamp like a minor searchlight, which we had found upon an illustrious-looking Rolls-Royce. I rigged the thing up on a kind of pivot beside the cab window and made it ready to plug in. When that was fixed, there was nothing to do but wait for darkness and hope that the rain would let up. By the time it was fully dark, the raindrops had become a mere spatter. I switched on and sent a magnificent beam piercing the night. Slowly I turned the lamp from side to side, keeping its ray leveled towards the opposite hills, while I anxiously tried to watch the whole line of them simultaneously for an answering light. A dozen times or more I traversed it steadily, switching off for a few seconds at the end of each sweep while we sought the least flicker in the darkness. But each time the night over the hills remained pitchy black. Then the rain came on more heavily again. I set the beam full ahead and sat waiting, listening to the drumming of the drops on the roof of the cab, while Susan fell asleep leaning against my arm. An hour passed before the drumming dwindled to a patter and ceased. Susan woke up as I started the beam raking across again. I had completed the sixth travel when she called out,
"Look! Bill! There it is! There's a light!"
She was pointing a few degrees left of our front. I switched off the lamp and followed the line of her finger. It was difficult to be sure. If it were not a trick of our eyes, it was something as dim as a distant glowworm. And even as we were looking at it, the rain came down on us again in sheets. By the time I had my glasses in my hand, there was no view at all. I hesitated to move. It might be that the light, if it had been a light, would not be visible from lower ground. Once more I trained our light forward and settled down to wait with as much patience as I could manage. Almost another hour passed before the rain cleared again. The moment it did, I switched off our lamp.
"It is!" Susan cried excitedly. "Look! Look!"
It was. and bright enough now to banish any doubts, though the glasses showed me no details. I switched on again and gave the V sign in Morse. It's the only Morse I know except SOS, so it had to do. While we watched the other light, it blinked, and then began a series of deliberate longs and shorts, which unfortunately meant nothing to me. I gave a couple more Vs for good measure, drew the approximate line of the far light on our map, and switched on the driving lights.
"Is that the lady?" asked Susan.
"It's got to be," I said. "It's got to be."
That was a poorish trip. To cross the low marshland, it was necessary to take a road a little to the west of us and then work back to the east along the foot of the hills. Before we had gone more than a mile, something cut off the sight of the light from us altogether, and to add to the difficulty of finding our way in the dark lanes, the rain began again in earnest. With no one to care for the drainage sluices, some fields were already flooded, and the water was over the road in places. I had to drive with a tedious care when all my urge was to put my foot flat down. Once we reached the further side of the valley, we were free of flood water, but we made little better speed, for the lanes were full of primitive wanderings and improbable turns. I had to give the wheel all my attention while the child peered up at the hills beside us, watching for the reappearance of the light. We reached the point where the line on my map intersected with what appeared to be our present road, without seeing a sign of it. I tried the next uphill turning. It took about half an hour to get back to the road again from the chalk pit into which it led us. We ran on further along the lower road. Then Susan caught a glimmer between the branches to our right. The next turning was luckier. It took us back at a slant up the side of the hill, until we were able to see a small, brilliantly lit square of window half a mile or more along the slope. Even then, and with the map to help, it was not easy to find the lane that led to it. We lurched along, still climbing in low gear, but each time we caught sight of the window again, it was a little closer. The lane had not been designed for ponderous lorries. In the narrower parts, we had to push our way along it between bushes and brambles, which scrabbled along the sides as though they were trying to pull us back. But at last, there was a lantern waving in the road ahead. It moved on, swinging to show us the turn through a gate. Then it was set stationary on the ground. I drove to within a yard or two of it, and stopped. As I opened the door, a flashlight shone suddenly into my eyes. I had a glimpse of a figure behind it in a raincoat, shining with wetness. A slight break marred the intended calm of the voice that spoke.
"Hello, Bill. You've been a long time."
I jumped down.
"Oh, Bill, I can't... Oh, my dear, I've been hoping so much... Oh, Bill,"
said Josella. I had forgotten all about Susan until a voice came from above.
"You are getting wet, you silly. Why don't you kiss her indoors?" it asked.
Chapter 14. Schoening. The sense with which I arrived at Schoening Farm, the one that told me that most of my troubles were now over, is interesting only in showing how wide of the mark a sense can be. The sweeping of Josella into my arms went off pretty well, but its corollary of carrying her away forthwith to join the others at Tynesham did not, for several reasons. Ever since her possible location had occurred to me, I had pictured her in, I must admit, a rather cinematic way, as battling bravely against all the forces of nature, etc., etc. In a fashion, I suppose she was, but the setup was a lot different from my imaginings. My simple plan of saying, "Jump aboard, we're off to join Coker and his little gang," had to go by the board. One might have known that things would not turn out so simply. On the other hand, it is surprising how often the better thing is disguised as the worse. Not that I didn't from the start prefer Schoening to the thought of Tynesham, but to join a larger group was obviously a sounder move. But Schoening was charming. The word farm had become a courtesy title for the place. It had been a farm until some 25 years before, and it still looked like a farm, but in reality it had become a country house. Sussex and the neighbouring counties were well dotted with such houses and cottages, which tired Londoners had found adaptable to their needs. Internally, the house had been modernized and reconstructed to a point where it was doubtful whether its previous tenants would be able to recognize a single room. Outside, it had become spick. The yards and sheds had a suburban rather than a rural tidiness, and had for years known no form of animal life rougher than a few riding horses and ponies. The farmyard showed no utilitarian sights, and gave forth no rustic smells. It had been laid over with close green turf like a bowling green. The fields across which the windows of the house gazed from beneath weathered red tiles had long been worked by the occupiers of other and more earthly farmhouses. But the sheds and barns remained in good condition. It had been the ambition of Gisella's friends, the present owners, to restore the place one day to work on a limited scale, and to this end they had continually refused tempting offers for it in the hope that at some time, and in some manner not clearly perceived, they would acquire enough money to start buying back the land rightfully belonging to it. With its own well and its own power plant, the place had plenty to recommend it. But as I looked it over, I understood Coker's wisdom in speaking of a cooperative effort. I knew nothing of farming, but I could feel that if we had intended to stay there, it would take a lot of work to feed six of us. The other three had been there already when Gisella had arrived. They were Dennis and Mary Brent and Joyce Taylor. Dennis was the owner of the house. Joyce had been there on an indefinite visit, at first to keep Mary company, and then to keep the house running when Mary's expected baby should be born. On the night of the green flashes of the comet, you would say if you were one who still believes in that comet, there had been two other guests, Joan and Ted Danton, spending a week's holiday there. All five of them had gone out into the garden to watch the display. In the morning, all five awoke to a world that was perpetually dark. First they had tried to telephone. When they found that impossible, they waited hopefully for the arrival of the daily help. She, too, failing them, Ted had volunteered to try and find out what had happened. Dennis would have accompanied him but for his wife's almost hysterical state. Ted, therefore, had set out alone. He did not come back. At some time later in the day, and without saying a word to anyone, Joan had slipped off, presumably to try and find her husband. She, too, disappeared completely. Dennis had kept track of time by touching the hands of the clock. By late afternoon, it was impossible to sit any longer doing nothing. He wanted to try to get down to the village. Both the women had objected to that. Because of Mary's state, he had yielded, and Joyce determined to try. She went to the door, and began to feel her way with a stick outstretched before her. She was barely over the threshold when something fell with a swish across her left hand, burning like a hot wire. She jumped back with a cry and collapsed in the hall where Dennis had found her. Luckily, she was conscious, and able to moan of the pain in her hand. Dennis, feeling the raised wheel, had guessed it for what it was. In spite of their blindness, he and Mary had somehow contrived to apply hot fermentations, she heating the kettle while he put on a tourniquet and did his best to suck out the poison. After that, they had had to carry her up to bed, where she stayed for several days, while the effect of the poison wore off. Meanwhile, Dennis had made tests, first at the front and then at the back of the house. With the door slightly open, he cautiously thrust out a broom at head level. Each time there was the whistle of a sting, and he felt the broom handle tremble slightly in his grip. At one of the garden windows the same thing happened. The others seemed to be clear. He would have tried to leave by one of them but for Mary's distress. She was sure that if there were Triffids close round the house there must be others about, and would not let him take the risk. Luckily, they had food enough to last them some time, though it was difficult to prepare it. Also Joyce, in spite of a high temperature, appeared to be holding her own against the Triffid poison, so that the situation was less urgent than it might have been. Most of the next day, Dennis devoted to contriving a kind of helmet for himself. He had wire net only of large mesh, so that he had to construct it of several layers overlapped and tied together. It took him some time, but equipped with this and a pair of heavy gauntlet gloves, he was able to start out for the village late in the day. A Triffid had struck at him before he was 3 paces away from the house. He groped for it until he found it, and twisted its stem for it. A minute or two later, another sting thudded across his helmet. He could not find that Triffid to grapple with it. though it made half a dozen slashes before it gave up. He found his way to the tool shed and thence across to the lane, encumbered now with three large balls of gardening twine which he paid out as he went to guide him back. Several times in the lane more stings whipped at him. It took an immensely long time for him to cover the mile or so to the village, and before he reached it, his supply of twine had given out. And all the time he had walked and stumbled through a silence so complete that it frightened him. Now and then he would stop and call, but no one answered. More than once he was afraid that he had lost his way, but when his feet discovered a better laid road surface he knew where he was, and was able to confirm it by locating a signpost. He groped his way further on. After a seemingly vast distance he had become aware that his footsteps were sounding differently. They had a faint echo. Moving to one side he found a footpath, and then a wall. A little further along he discovered a postbox let into the brickwork, and he knew that he must be actually in the village at last. He called out once more. A voice, a woman's voice, called back, but it was some distance ahead and the words were indistinguishable. He called again and began to move towards it. Its reply was suddenly cut off by a scream. After that, there was silence again. Only then, and still half incredulously, did he realize that the village was in no better plight than his own household. He sat down on the grassed verge of the path to think out what he should do. By the feeling in the air, he thought that night must have come. He must have been away fully 4 hours, and there was nothing to do but go back. All the same, there was no reason why he should go back empty-handed. With his stick, he rapped his way along the wall until it rang on one of the tin-plate advertisements which adorned the village shop. 3 times in the last 50 or 60 yards, stings had slapped on his helmet. Another struck as he opened the gate, and he tripped over a body lying on the path. A man's body, quite cold. He had the impression that there had been others in the shop before him. Nevertheless, he found a sizable piece of bacon. He dropped it, along with packets of butter or margarine, biscuits and sugar, into a sack, and added an assortment of tins which came from a shelf that, to the best of his recollection, was devoted to food. The sardine tins, at any rate, were unmistakable. Then he sought for and found a dozen or more balls of string, shouldered his sack, and set off for home. He had missed his way once, and it had been hard to keep down panic while he retraced his steps and reorientated himself. But at last he knew that he was again in the familiar lane. By groping right across it, he managed to locate the twine of his outward journey and join it to the string. From there, the rest of the journey back had been comparatively easy. Twice more in the week that followed he had made the journey to the village shop again, and each time the triffids round the house and on the way had seemed more numerous. There had been nothing for the isolated trio to do but wait in hope. And then, like a miracle, Josella had arrived. It was clear at once then that the notion of an immediate move to Tynesham was out. For one thing, Joyce Taylor was still in an extremely weak state. When I looked at her, I was surprised that she was alive at all. Dennis's promptness had saved her life, but their inability to give her the proper restoratives or even suitable food during the following week had slowed down her recovery. It would be folly to try to move her a long distance for a week or two yet. And then, too, Mary's confinement was close enough to make the journey inadvisable for her, so that the only course seemed to be for us all to remain where we were until these crises should have passed. Once more it became my task to scrounge and forage. This time I had to work on a more elaborate scale to include not merely food but petrol for the lighting system, hens that were laying, 2 cows that had recently calved and still survived though their ribs were sticking out, medical necessities for Mary, and a surprising list of sundries. The area was more beset with triffids than any other I had yet seen. Almost every morning revealed 1 or 2 new ones lurking close to the house, and the first task of the day was to shoot the tops off them, until I had constructed a netting fence to keep them out of the garden. Even then they would come right up and loiter suggestively against it until something was done about them. I opened some of the cases of gear, and taught young Susan how to use a Triffid gun. She quite rapidly became an expert at disarming the things, as she continued to call them. It became her department to work daily vengeance on them. From Gisella, I learnt what had happened to her after the fire alarm at the university building. She had been shipped off with her party much as I with mine, but her manner of dealing with the two women to whom she was attached had been summary. She had issued a flat ultimatum. Either she became free of all restraints, in which case she would help them as far as she was able, or if they continued to coerce her, there would be likely to come a time when they would find themselves drinking prussic acid or eating cyanide of potassium on her recommendation. They could take their choice. They had chosen sensibly. There was little difference in what we had to tell one another about the days that had followed. When her group had in the end dissolved, she had reasoned much as I did. She took a car and went up to Hampstead to look for me. She had not encountered any survivors from my group, nor run across that led by the quick-triggered red-headed man. She had kept on there until almost sunset, and then decided to make for the university building. Not knowing what to expect, she had cautiously stopped the car a couple of streets away and approached on foot. When she was still some distance from the gates, she heard a shot. Wondering what that might indicate, she had taken cover in the garden that had sheltered us before. From there, she had observed Coker also making a circumspect advance. Without knowing that I had fired at the Triffid in the square, and that the sound of the shot was the cause of Coker's caution, she suspected some kind of trap. Determined not to fall into one a second time, she had returned to the car. She had no idea where the rest had gone, if they had gone at all. The only place of refuge she could think of that would be known to anyone at all was the one she had mentioned almost casually to me. She had decided to make for it in the hope that I, if I was still in existence, would remember and try to find it. "I curled up and slept in the back of the car once I was clear of London," she said. "It was still quite early when I got here the next morning. The sound of the car brought Dennis to an upstairs window, warning me to look out for Triffids. Then I saw that there were half a dozen or more of them close around the house, for all the world as if they were waiting for someone to come out of it. Dennis and I shouted back and forth. The Triffid stirred, and one of them began to move towards me, so I nipped back into the car for safety. When it kept on coming, I started up the car and deliberately ran it down. But there were still the others, and I had no kind of weapon but my knife. It was Dennis who solved that difficulty.
"If you have a can of petrol to spare, throw some of it their way and follow it up with a bit of burning rag," he suggested. "That ought to shift 'em."
It did. Since then I've been using a garden syringe. The wonder is that I've not set the place on fire. With the aid of a cookbook, Gisella had managed to produce meals of a kind, and had set about putting the place more or less to rights. Working, learning, and improvising had kept her too busy to worry about a future which lay beyond the next few weeks. She had seen no one else at all during those days. But certain that there must be others somewhere, she had scanned the whole valley for signs of smoke by day or lights by night. She had seen no smoke, and in all the miles within her view, there had not been a gleam of light until the evening I came. In a way, the worst affected of the original trio was Dennis. Joyce was still weak and in a semi-invalid state. Mary held herself withdrawn and seemed capable of finding endless mental occupation and compensation in the contemplation of prospective motherhood. But Dennis was like an animal in a trap. He did not curse in the futile way I had heard so many others do. He resented it with a vicious bitterness, as if it had forced him into a cage where he did not intend to stay. Already before I arrived, he had prevailed upon Gisella to find the Braille system in the encyclopedia and make an indented copy of the alphabet for him to learn. He spent dogged hours each day making notes in it and attempting to read them back. Most of the rest of the time he fretted over his own uselessness, though he scarcely mentioned it. He would keep on trying to do this or that with a grim persistence that was painful to watch, and it required all my self-control to stop me offering him help. One experience of the bitterness which unasked help could arouse in him was quite enough. I began to be astonished at the things he was painfully teaching himself to do, though still the most impressive to me was his construction of an efficient mesh helmet on only the second day of his blindness. It took him out of himself to accompany me on some of my foraging expeditions. And it pleased him that he could be useful in helping to move the heavier cases. He was anxious for books in Braille, but these we decided would have to wait until there was less risk of contamination in towns large enough to be likely sources. The days began to pass quickly, certainly for the three of us who could see. Josella was kept busy, mostly in the house, and Susan was learning to help her. There were plenty of jobs, too, waiting to be done by me. Joyce recovered sufficiently to make a shaky first appearance, and then began to pick up more rapidly. Soon after that, Mary's pains began. That was a bad night for everyone. Worst, perhaps, for Dennis, in knowing that everything depended on the care of two willing but inexperienced girls. His self-control aroused my helpless admiration. In the early hours of the morning, Josella came down to us looking very tired.
"It's a girl.
They're both all right," she said, and led Dennis up. She returned a few moments later and took the drink I had ready for her.
"It was quite simple, thank heaven," she said. "Poor Mary was horribly afraid it might be blind too, but of course it's not. Now she's crying quite dreadfully because she can't see it."
We drank.
"It's queer," I said, "the way things go on, I mean. Like a seed. It looks all shriveled and finished. You think it was dead, but it isn't. And now a new life starting, coming into all this."
Josella put her face in her hands.
"Oh, God. Bill, does it have to go on being like this? On and on and on."
And she, too, collapsed in tears. 3 weeks later, I went over to Tynesham to see Coker and make arrangements for our move. I took an ordinary car in order to do the double journey in a day. When I got back, Josella met me in the hall. She gave one look at my face.
"What's the matter?" she said.
"Just that we shan't be going there after all," I told her. "Tynesham is finished." She stared back at me.
"What happened?"
"I'm not sure. It looks as if the plague got there." I described the state of affairs briefly. It had not needed much investigation. The gates were open when I arrived, and the sight of triffids loose in the park half warned me what to expect. The smell when I got out of the car confirmed it. I made myself go into the house. By the look of it, it had been deserted 2 weeks or more before. I put my head into two of the rooms. They were enough for me. I called, and my voice ran right away through the hollowness of the house. I went no further. There had been a notice of some kind pinned to the front door, but only one blank corner remained. I spent a long time searching for the rest of the sheet that must have blown away. I did not find it. The yard at the back was empty of lorries and cars, and most of the stores had gone with them, but where to, I could not tell. There was nothing to be done but get into my car again and come back.
"And so, what?"
asked Josella, when I had finished.
"And so, my dear, we stay here.
We learn how to support ourselves. And we go on supporting ourselves, unless help comes. There may be an organization somewhere." Josella shook her head.
"I think we'd better forget all about help. Millions and millions of people have been waiting and hoping for help that hasn't come."
"There'll be something," I said. "There must be thousands of little groups like this dotted all over Europe, all over the world. Some of them will get together. They'll begin to rebuild."
"In how long?" said Josella. "Generations? Perhaps not until after our time." "No. The world's gone, and we're left. We must make our own lives. We'll have to plan them as though help will never come."
She paused. There was an odd, blank look on her face that I had never seen before. It puckered.
"Darling," I said. "Oh, Bill. Bill, I wasn't meant for this kind of life. If you weren't here, I—"
"Hush, my sweet," I said gently. Hush. I stroked her hair. A few moments later, she recovered herself.
Sorry, Bill. Self-pity. Revolting. Never again.
She patted her eyes with a handkerchief and sniffed a little.
So I'm to be a farmer's wife. Anyway, I like being married to you, Bill. Even if it isn't a very proper, authentic kind of marriage.
Suddenly she gave the smiling chuckle that I had not heard for some time. What is it?
I was only thinking how much I used to dread my wedding.
That was very maidenly and proper of you. If a little unexpected, I told her.
Well, it wasn't exactly that. It was my publishers, and the newspapers, and the film people. What fun they would have had with it. There'd have been a new edition of my silly book, probably a new release of the film, and pictures in all the papers. I don't think you'd have liked that much.
I can think of another thing I'd have not liked much, I told her. Do you remember that night in the moonlight you made a condition? She looked at me.
Well, maybe some things haven't fallen out so badly, she said.
Chapter 15. World Narrowing. From then on, I kept a journal. It is a mixture of diary, stock list, and commonplace book. In it, there are notes of the places to which my expeditions took me, particulars of the supplies collected, estimates of quantities available, observations on the states of the premises, with memos on which should be cleared first to avoid deterioration. Foodstuffs, fuel, and seed were constant objects of search, but by no means the only ones. There are entries detailing loads of clothing, tools, household linen, harness, kitchenware, loads of stakes and wire, wire and more wire. Also books. I can see there that within a week of my return from Tynesham I had started on the work of erecting a wire fence to keep the Triffids out. Already we had barriers to hold them away from the garden and the immediate neighbourhood of the house. Now I began a more ambitious plan of making some 100 acres or so free from them. It involved a stout wire fence which took advantage of the natural features and standing barriers, and inside it a lighter fence to prevent either the stock or ourselves from coming inadvertently within sting range of the main fence. It was a heavy, tedious job, which took me a number of months to complete. At the same time, I was endeavouring to learn the ABC of farming. It is not the kind of thing that is easily learnt from books. For one thing, it had never occurred to any writer on the subject that any potential farmer could be starting from absolute zero. I found, therefore, that all works began, as it were, in the middle, taking for granted both a basis and a vocabulary that I did not have. My specialised biological knowledge was all but useless to me in the face of practical problems. Much of the theory called for materials and substances which were either unavailable to me or unrecognizable by me if I could find them. I began to see quite soon that by the time I had dismissed the things that would shortly be unprocurable, such as chemical fertilizers, imported feeding stuffs, and all but the simpler kinds of machinery, there was going to be much expenditure of sweat for problematical returns. Nor is book-instilled knowledge of horse management, dairy work, or slaughterhouse procedure by any means an adequate groundwork for these arts. There are so many points where one cannot break off to consult the relative chapter. Moreover, the realities persistently present baffling dissimilarities from the simplicities of print. Luckily, there was plenty of time to make mistakes and to learn from them. The knowledge that several years could pass before we should be thrown anywhere near on our own resources saved us from desperation over our disappointments. There was the reassuring thought, too, that by living on preserved stores, we were really being quite provident in preventing them from being wasted. For safety's sake, I let a whole year pass before I went to London again. It was the most profitable area for my forays, but it was the most depressing. The place still contrived to give the impression that a touch of a magic wand would bring it to life again, though many of the vehicles in the streets were beginning to turn rusty. A year later, the change was more noticeable. Large patches of plaster detached from house fronts had begun to litter the pavements. Dislodged tiles and chimney pots could be found in the streets. Grass and weeds had a good hold in the gutters and were choking the drains. Leaves had blocked downspouting so that more grass and even small bushes grew in cracks and in the silt in the roof gutterings. Almost every building was beginning to wear a green wig beneath which its roofs would damply rot. Through many a window one had glimpses of fallen ceilings, curves of peeling paper and walls glistening with damp. The gardens of the parks and squares were wildernesses creeping out across the bordering streets. Growing things seemed indeed to press out everywhere, rooting in the crevices between the paving stones, springing from cracks in concrete, finding lodgments even in the seats of the abandoned cars. On all sides they were encroaching to repossess themselves of the arid spaces that man had created. And curiously, as the living things took charge increasingly, the effect of the place became less oppressive. As it passed beyond the scope of any magic wand, most of the ghosts were going with it, withdrawing slowly into history. Once, not that year nor the next, but later on, I stood in Piccadilly Circus again, looking round at the desolation, and trying to recreate in my mind's eye the crowds that once swarmed there. I could no longer do it. Even in my memory they lacked reality. There was no tincture of them now. They had become as much a backcloth of history as the audiences in the Roman Colosseum, or the army of the Assyrians, and somehow just as far removed. The nostalgia that crept over me sometimes in the quiet hours was able to move me to more regret than the crumbling scene itself. When I was by myself in the country, I could recall the pleasantness of the former life. Among the scabrous, slowly perishing buildings, I seemed able to recall only the muddle, the frustration, the unaimed drive, the all-pervading clangor of empty vessels, and I became uncertain how much we had lost. My first tentative trip there I took alone, returning with cases of Triffid bolts, paper, engine parts, the braille books and writing machine that Dennis so much desired, the luxuries of drinks, sweets, records, and yet more books for the rest of us. A week later, Josella came with me on a more practical search for clothing, not only or even chiefly for the adults of the party, so much as for Mary's baby and the one she herself was now expecting. It upset her, and it remained the only visit she made. I continued to go there from time to time in search of some scarce necessity, and used to seize the opportunity of a few little luxuries at the same time. Never once did I see any moving thing there save a few sparrows and an occasional triffid. Cats and dogs, growing wilder at each generation, could be found in the country, but not there. Sometimes, however, I would find evidence that others besides myself were still in the habit of quarrying supplies there, but I never saw them. It was at the end of the fourth year that I made my last trip, and found that there were now risks which I was not justified in taking. The first intimation of that was a thunderous crash behind me somewhere in the inner suburbs. I stopped the truck and looked back to see the dust rising from a heap of rubble which lay across the road. Evidently my rumbling passage had given the last shake to a tottering house front. I brought no more buildings down that day, but I spent it in apprehension of a descending torrent of bricks and mortar. Thereafter, I confined my attention to smaller towns, and usually went about them on foot. Brighton, which should have been our largest convenient source of supplies, I let alone. By the time I had thought it fit for a visit, others were in charge there. Who or how many they were, I did not know. I simply found a rough wall of stones piled across the road, and painted with the instruction, "Keep out." The advice was backed up by the crack of a rifle and a spurt of dust just in front of me. There was no one in sight to argue with. Besides, it wasn't an arguing kind of gambit. I turned the lorry round and drove away thoughtfully. I wondered if a time would come when the man Stephen's preparations for defence might turn out to be not so misplaced after all. Just to be on the safe side, I laid in several machine guns and mortars from the source which had already provided us with the flamethrowers we used against the Triffids. In the November of that second year, Josella's first baby was born. We called him David. My pleasure in him was at times alloyed with misgivings over the state of things we had created him to face. But that worried Josella much less than it did me. She adored him. He seemed to be a compensation to her for much that she had lost. And paradoxically, she started to worry less over the condition of the bridges ahead than she had before. Anyway, he had a lustiness which argued well for his future capacity to take care of himself. So I repressed my misgivings and increased the work I was putting into that land which would one day have to support all of us. It must have been not so very long after that that Josella turned my attention more closely to the Triffids. I had for years been so used to taking precautions against them in my work that their becoming a regular part of the landscape was far less noticeable to me than it was to the others. I had been accustomed, too, to wearing meshed masks and gloves when I dealt with them, so that there was little novelty for me in donning these things whenever I drove out. I had, in fact, got into the habit of paying little more attention to them than one would to mosquitoes in a known malarial area. Josella mentioned it as we lay in bed one night, when almost the only sound was the intermittent distant rattling of their hard little sticks against their stems. "They're doing a lot more of that lately," she said. I did not grasp at first what she was talking about. It was a sound that had been a usual background to the places where I had lived and worked for so long, that unless I deliberately listened for it, I could not say whether it was going on or not. I listened now. "Doesn't sound any different to me," I said. "It's not different. It's just that there's more of it, because there are a lot more of them than there used to be." "I hadn't noticed," I said indifferently. Once I had the fence fixed up, my interest had lain in the ground within it, and I had not bothered what went on beyond it. My impression on my expeditions was that the incidence of Triffids in most parts was much the same as before. I recalled that their numbers locally had caught my attention when I had first arrived, and that I had supposed that there must have been several large Triffid nurseries in the district. "There certainly are. You take a look at them tomorrow," she said. I remembered in the morning, and looked out of the window as I was dressing. I saw that Josella was right. One could count over 100 of them behind the quite small stretch of fence visible from the window. I mentioned it at breakfast. Susan looked surprised. "But they've been getting more all the time," she said. "Haven't you noticed?" "I've got plenty of other things to bother about," I said, a little irritated by her tone. "They don't matter outside the fence anyway. As long as we take care to pull up all the seeds that root in here, they can do what they like outside." "All the same," Josella remarked with a trace of uneasiness, "is there any particular reason why they should come to just this part in such numbers? I'm sure they do. And I'd like to know just why it is." Susan's face took on its irritating expression of surprise again. "Why, he brings them," she said. "Don't point," Josella told her automatically. "What do you mean? I'm sure Bill doesn't bring them." "Well, he does. He makes all the noises, and they just come." "Look here," I said, "what are you talking about? Am I supposed to be whistling them here in my sleep or something?" Susan looked huffy. "All right, if you don't believe me, I'll show you after breakfast," she announced, and withdrew into an offended silence. When we had finished, she slipped from the table, returning with my 12-bore and field glasses. We went out onto the lawn. She scoured the view until she found a Triffid on the move well beyond our fences, and then handed the glasses to me. I watched the thing lurching slowly across a field. It was more than a mile away from us, and heading east. "Now keep on watching it," she said. She fired the gun into the air. A few seconds later, the Triffid perceptibly altered course towards the south. "See?" she inquired, rubbing her shoulder. "Well, it did look... Are you sure? Try again," I suggested. She shook her head. "It won't be any good. All the Triffids that heard it are coming this way now. In about 10 minutes they'll stop and listen. If they're near enough then to hear the ones by the fence clattering, they'll come on. Or if they're too far away for that but we make another noise, then they'll come. But if they can't hear anything at all, they'll wait a bit and then just go on wherever they were going before. I admit that I was somewhat taken aback by this revelation.
Well, I said, you must have been watching them very closely, Susan.
I always watch them. I hate them, she said, as if that were explanation enough. Dennis had joined us as we stood there.
I'm with you, Susan, he said. I don't like it. I've not liked it for some time. Those damn things have the drop on us.
Oh, come, I began. I tell you, there's more to them than we think. How did they know? They started to break loose the moment there was no one to stop them. They were around this house the very next day. Can you account for that?
That's not new for them, I said. In jungle country, they used to hang around near the tracks. Quite often they would surround a small village and invade it if they weren't beaten off. They were a dangerous kind of pest in quite a lot of places.
But not here, that's my point. They couldn't do that here until conditions made it possible. They didn't even try. But when they could, they did it at once. Almost as if they knew they could.
Oh, come on, be reasonable, Dennis. Just think what you're implying, I told him.
I'm quite aware of what I'm implying. Some of it, at any rate. I'm making no definite theory, but I do say this. They took advantage of our disadvantages with remarkable speed. I also say there is something perceptibly like method going on among them right now. You've been so wrapped up in your jobs that you've not noticed how they've been massing up and waiting out there beyond the fence, but Susan has. I've heard her talking about it. And just what do you think they're waiting for?
I did not try to answer that just then. I said, you think I'd better lay off using the 12-bore which attracts them and use a Triffid gun instead?
It's not just the gun, it's all noises, said Susan.
Oh, the tractor's the worst because it's a loud noise and it keeps on, so they can easily find where it comes from. But they can hear the lighting plant engine quite a long way, too. I've seen them turn this way when it starts up.
I wish, I told her irritably, you'd not keep on saying they hear as if they were animals. They're not. They don't hear. They're just plants.
All the same, they do hear anyhow, Susan retorted stubbornly.
Well, anyway, we'll do something about them, I promised.
End of Disc 7.